Sacred geometry is a system so vast, it can literally blow our minds. Maybe it's supposed to. Robert Lawler is the man for this and many things. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Robert, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. It's great to be back in Colorado and in Boulder. I spent quite a number of years in this area.
Robert, how you arrived to now is an impossible question, of course, for our one-half-hour show, but what one thread can you follow from your early days as a sculptor to today?
I actually don't think there's one thread.
That's honest. That's fair.
Probably the biggest impetus to leave the world of modern art and in the 60s in New York was discovering a book that pointed out that there was never any art, architecture, music, poetry, any expressions of art that were not dominated by following the laws of geometric form and symmetry and the laws of harmonics in sound. And that just threw me, being part of this school of abstract expressionism and the internalization of our inner life. And I started looking in books and seeing how geometry was a way of perfecting the reproduction of space in art. So from there, it just started to be a search that included the fact that I almost poisoned myself with sculptural materials that I was working on for my first exhibit in New York City. And the irony of that, reaching the point of what I had always wanted to be my whole life, was an artist and painter. And on the threshold of a show in an important gallery in New York, and to have used a material that could have crippled me if I hadn't been able to discharge it through purification and fasting.
Wow. So you went into a fasting mode.
Yeah. For a number of years, I had to do that. As I fasted, I traveled. I got a ticket on a freighter, and with a bag of brown rice, I went through Turkey and met someone in Istanbul who was returning to India, and we hitchhiked through Iraq and Syria and Jordan, and then from Jordan went on the Red Sea to India. And as soon as I got to India, I realized, like in the Middle East, you just showed your passport at the borderline, and in India you had to have a visa first, and I got put in jail as just entering India. And so my Indian friend left me, and it took me about 3 days to convince them that they either had to send me back, but I couldn't stay in jail forever for that. After all, I didn't have a visa.
Right.
So that started my relationship with India and the exploration of ancient culture and meaning, source of meaning. And while I was in India, I met a man who was the only student of R.A. Schwelier de Lubitz, who did the great work on finding out the mathematical thought and how their mathematical principles conformed to their view of reality. And he wrote a 1,300-page book called The Temple of Man, which took my partner and I 8 years to translate into English. And so in that way, I got totally absorbed in Egyptian thought and also reconciling the relationship between the worldview of India and the worldview of ancient Egypt.
Was this author who wrote The Temple of Man, was all of his mathematics directly sacred geometry?
No, he worked from two of the major mathematical papyri that the Egyptians left. One was the Rin papyrus, and the scribe wrote down 120 problems, and he wrote down the problem, and then he wrote down the answer. And none of the scholars could figure, well, how are they getting these answers? Do they have binomial algebra? And he worked out that all of their calculating and problem-solving techniques were based on the laws of sacred geometry, of the principles of symmetry in form, and on the laws of harmonics and sound. So it was really interesting to enter the technique of solving problems by utilizing only these abstract principles.
I believe this quote I'm going to quote is perhaps from that book, "A Living Proportion Becomes Invisible When It's Alive." To me, that is like throwing the stone in the water and watching the continuous circles form, because the reverberations really do stretch out into every aspect of life. So you were just speaking about how your art all of a sudden sort of lost its... everything, because it didn't have this element to it, and how that proportion becomes part of the living.
Yeah, everything follows certain proportional relationships. And the basis of proportional relationship begins with what we call a ratio. And ratios occur as responses from our sensory organs. A ratio is acknowledging that there's a difference. There is something that you can say is A and something else that is B. It is the comparison of differences that is at the basis of our thinking processes, which we call rational. So all of these processes are not only fundamental to our sensory perception of a world that is also created by these same principles. And so it is a way in which the consciousness, the embodied consciousness that is separated in the movement of Genesis, also at the same time always maintains proportional relatedness. And then there's the great relationship of extremes of differences, like the larger division or the smaller division of any distance or dimension. And there is one way that the larger and the smaller can relate. In that way, it also relates to every other partition and to the whole thing. And that's called the golden mean. And this is how you can move from just formulas related to the idea of proportion into a whole basic philosophy that reaches to the very source and meaning of our existence.
Going back to source and meaning within your investigation and experience in India, you certainly studied and found out about the yugas and that we are in a Kali Yuga right now. Maybe you can start with telling us what that actually means. And then I'd kind of like to investigate a little bit. What do you think it is about the human? Why is a man so hell-bent almost on dividing everything up? We divide it up, and then that kind of creates an end and a beginning. And an end creates a death, and then man is so afraid of dying and death, and it rules their life.
Well, the thing is, unless there is a process of living and dying, we would be left with an absolutely static and stifled creation. And as the Gnostics say, it is only death that can bestow rebirth. If we can understand the metaphysics that not only do individuals go through a fixed cycles of time, we all will be, if we live long enough, experience four distinct stages of life. And the yuga system, in terms of cosmic time, does the same thing of going through four distinct ages, and then that cycle begins over and over again. What I did to begin with, I have translated a book by a French Indianologist who was an extremely gifted linguist. And so much so that he not only learned Sanskrit and Hindi, the languages of North India, but he learned the Dravidian languages of South India, what we call the Tamils. He was the first Western intellect to do that. He also spoke fluently about six of the major European languages. So Nehru, when Alan was in India, started using him in diplomatic conversations with India. And while Alan was there working, a sadhu came to him and said, "It has been decided by the Brotherhood of Sadhus that the Western world should now know the true duration of the yugas." And he gave him a book, the Linga Purana. These are some of the oldest writings in the Indian literature. And just close to the end of his life, he wrote a short appendix about the duration of the yuga. And I, in translating that book, I said, "Well, what does this number mean? Why does this?" And these numbers are so big that, you know, why worry? But that was not the yuga that affects humanity. That is the yuga of the cosmos. I show in the book exactly how the yuga of human consciousness and the development of human consciousness, which is the human yuga, what its duration is, and how it works in terms of all the other really long count calendars. For instance, the precession of the equinox. So the precession of the equinox is an astronomical fact that the sun moves against the background of fixed stars 1 degree every 72 years. Moving at that rate, it will come back to its position 25,920 years. And so these 12 positions of the sun make like the face of a clock of 12 hours. And the yuga system interacts with the precession in certain areas which produce the yugas. And the yugas are directly related to the various developments of human consciousness.
There are many people in the world who will never hear of a yuga. What is it in man now that actually we all would recognize in ourselves, perhaps, or the way things are for man today that actually is coinciding with what you're talking about?
The Linga Purana, which was supposed to go back 12,000 years, it was transmitted. And every educated Indian scholar knows the duration of the yuga. And everyone knows that the yuga began in 3102 BC. And they also knew that in 1938, when we learned the capacities to split the elements of the atom, and at that date, Hitler launched into the beginning of the Second World War, that was the beginning of the twilight of this Kali Yuga. That is the key that gave me the incentive to study that number and find out how it relates to the laws of form and to the principles of harmonics. But at the same time, I discovered the work of a Russian physicist, Nicholas Kozarev, who proved in 30 years of research that time is not just this neutral wallpaper of seconds, minutes, hours, and that we measure movement in space, because that's basically what Newtonian and Einstein is about, but that time is, in certain durations, an active force, as active in the physical world as electromagnetism. And that is exactly the theory of the yuga. And it's exactly a theory that we live from childhood. It just takes 7 years, and a child's teeth will fall out and new teeth will come in. 7 years later, suddenly we move from childhood into the adolescence and we become sexualized beings. And the whole pattern of our life is in four stages, just like the yuga system is for the cosmos. So it's those kinds of relationships in this book, verifying the specific date of the Yuga. The core date of the Kali Yuga is 5,040 years. I discovered that if you take the radius of the moon and the radius of the earth and add them together, they are in miles exactly equal to the number of years in the Kali Yuga. Add those two together and you have a form that is resonant with the frequency level of the Kali Yuga. When the Earth and Moon, they move together, they send out this vibration into the universe. And it is this vibration that travels as a determinative, creative level of time.
How does it serve you? What are you aware of on a personal day-to-day level, and how can that serve humanity?
Well, anyone who has been moved by the destructiveness of the Earth's environment, since the 1960s, we started to be aware. We're all participating in a system that is destroying the Earth. We are philosophically and economically tied into this process of constant growth. I just found that the Yuga system makes it possible to conjecture that there is a meaningful, necessary, metaphysical override to this process. It's not just simple destruction. We are bringing this civilization to the death, and the end of this particular stage of human nature. The destruction of the Earth will be the destruction of ourselves. This is what the American natives have said from the beginning. We're part of the web. We destroy the web, we destroy ourselves. This is not simply a darkness. We are at the end of this stage. We need a death and rebirth in order to continue the process of the embodiment of consciousness.
Yes, so how metaphysically are you speaking? If this has been prophesied by the Indians, the Egyptians, the American Indians, the Mayans, how do we best serve the time, serve ourselves? If we're going down, then we're going down, and it is as it is. And
yeah. I think anyone who is fortunate enough to realize that they're in a terminal phase of their own life, whether it's by disease or other things, has an enormous opportunity to reflect on what they were and what they were not. And I also believe that if we can realize that we are going through a death that will enable the continuation before we destroy this planet completely, that there is a metaphysical force that will bring this phase to an end. You see, we think because of Darwinism that we're some sort of superior species, but we are just another phase in the fetal womb of the Yuga process. And when one fetal phase is done, it has to be bypassed and surpassed, and a new form has to begin within the egg of rebirth. There is an Indian quote, if I can remember it: the natural world is infinitely malleable, but when the manipulation of matter becomes the central force in a society, it is a clear mark of severe degeneracy.
It's that known and unknown, or visible and invisible, that allows for the true alchemy.
And that's been one of the great faults of our science, and why materialistic Western science is destroying the Earth. They have worked arduously to ignore or deny the fact that there is a metaphysical element to the entire physical world. No society before us denied that. And this is the one of the greatest errors that we've ever made. And what I feel that the yuga system can do is it makes us understand that the important thing is consciousness. And that consciousness in Indian thought is consciousness does not exist. It is existence. And time and space are like consciousness. There is no way that we can discover what is the existence, what's the form, what's the measure, what's the extent, what's the limits, what's the unlimited to time nor space. They're not rational. They're the presence of a metaphysical device for consciousness to enter into the formal world. Becoming conscious of how time operates and admit that we're not on this climb to great mechanized civilization that is judging information by the quantity. What does the quantity have to do with knowledge? We've got to understand what knowledge is, not quantification of information. So this is the Indian thought about consciousness does not exist. It is existence. In the phenomenal world, there is nothing that is absolutely conscious nor absolutely unconscious. Consciousness and unconsciousness are always intermingled. Some things, however, appear to be more conscious and more unconscious than others. We only can understand time as past, present, and future, and space as height, width, and depth. We make trinities, but the actual essence of the force or phenomenon is unlimited. We also have this trinity that stands at the figurehead of this process. And one is existence, the other is chit, consciousness, that's the point of the triangle, and ananda, that's the wonderful joys that are intermingled and blended into the beauty of life and the beauty that comes out of the process of a purely metaphysical status, consciousness embodying itself in form and in nature. Consciousness is never absent in anything, yet manifests itself in various ways and various degrees. The degrees of this manifestation is determined by the nature and development of the mind and body in which that consciousness is enshrined. So if we could understand ourselves as being an enshrinement of consciousness, and it's not the shrine, but it's the consciousness that will pass through the creations and destructions that are necessary for the perfection of this process, an embodiment of universal consciousness.
There certainly is a universality to all of this knowledge from ancient cultures, isn't there?
I was able to discover that the yuga number is the exact number of units that are at the base of the pyramid, and that the Sphinx that was built outside the pyramid, when it turns exactly opposite to a moment in 10,518, when the Sphinx was facing due east and the sign Leo rose over the horizon. And Leo is the Sphinx of the heavens. When it turns around in a complete half circle for that moment, which was written down in an Egyptian papyri as the moment when the earth and the heavens were in complete confluence, the Sphinx turns all the way around then to face Aquarius opposite, and it faces exactly on the same date as that confluence of the earth and heaven, the point where the Kali Yuga brings about the end of time. So the Sphinx and the pyramids are yuga monuments. And so there is always shared knowledge between all the cultures I've studied, and I haven't studied a lot of cultures. I've just had a time to spend quite a lot of time with Australian Aborigines, and 7 years in India, and I don't know how many years with books on Egypt and visits there. Mm-hmm. When I first started to get to know Aboriginal people in Australia, they heard that I was a writer, and they came to me and they said, we have got to have enough funding so we can develop an alcohol rehabilitation center, because so many Aboriginal men have been swept away by alcohol. And so we talked it over, and they came and they brought their uncles and their the elders, and we talked about how we could do it and what they wanted me to say and how I could put the program into words. And so after talking to me a while, one of them said, where did you get that language? And I said, well, what do you mean, that language? And he said, well, you put thoughts together in a different way. You sort of put thoughts together the way we do. And, you know, you think on different levels all at the same time. And I said, well, some of that comes from Egypt, because the Egyptians believed that unless something has at least six connections between physical and metaphysical metaphors, if it doesn't have at least six, it's not worth writing down. And I said, I try to think that way. And he said, Aboriginals think that way, too.
There we are. Robert, what do you do personally when you want to hunker down and reimagine? Of course, most of us are aware of how the Aborigines had their dream time. Dreaming was a very important part of life. And were they being dreamed, or were they dreaming?
Dreaming is, I like to think dreaming is the way we think when we're asleep. And we all pass through this dual process as long as we live. We're asleep and we're awake. It forms a boundary line, and it's in that boundary line that we can understand the way we are and our intelligence is embedded in this process of pure metaphysical activity. When we have a thought, we are turning an absolute amorphous energy into a focalized concept. And a concept is then a beginning of a form. So we're sharing in the same process that the universe is. The Gnostics say that the entire creation of the universe is just a single thought in a universal consciousness. And that thought is what's making and driving all these generations of forms and species and phenomena.
Could you share what your process is when you slow down and stop and want to exist in the consciousness? Do you have a type of meditation you do, or...
Because I've been writing and formulating and attempting to act as someone who's transiting and transmitting knowledge from the past. So my meditation is partly in a dreaming state. It's most of the ideas come forth just as when I awake. And I don't sit and try to silence my mind.
That's always a good plan, I think.
Yeah. I try to listen to those times when the process of conceptualization is at its peak, and my quietness is the attempt to listen to that level.
Robert Lawler. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. For podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.